This is a special closed-circuit presentation of Zero Hour, the new radio drama series with Rod Serling, which will premiere over Mutual on December 17th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Details have been sent to all stations. What will follow is a 14-minute condensation of one half-hour episode starring Academy Award winner George Kennedy. This condensation is not for broadcast. It is for audition and sales purposes only. Write a first call for all affiliates expires Monday, November 19th. Stations desiring clearance are urged to contact station relations as soon as possible. Now, Mr. Serling.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to the Zero Hour. Rest your eyes. Exercise your imagination. This week, Charles Larson's inside story of television murder. Someone's death. Starring George Kennedy. Joyce Boulafont. And Robert Reed. In Elliot Lewis's production of The Zero Hour. Just when we are safest, there's a sunset touch, a fancy from a flower bell, someone's death, a chorus ending from Euripides. Robert Browning on Men and Women. For television producer Nils Frederik Blixen, someone's death was prologue to a show unwritten. He cast himself in the hero's role. His youthful casting director, Joanna Redfern, his leading lady. But somebody is not following the script. A second someone's death has been written in. Nor is Joanna Redfern playing her part as she should. The heroine is not supposed to be found at the scene of the crime, with blood on her hands. For Nils Frederik Blixen, life behind the camera was never this frustrating. But that's the difference between fiction and fact. And the fact remains, someone's death was murder.
One would have thought, seeing Heidi, that she'd fallen asleep over her book. She'd been struck twice in the face by a sharp instrument with a long blade, probably an axe. The murderer may have been splashed, probably had been. An examination would show traces of blood in the trap under the kitchen sink where he or she had washed. No one in the fourplex had heard a sound. The murder weapon was nowhere to be seen. I stood in the doorway and watched a police car drive red away, the face in the window blurred by rain. Sergeant Ames, I want Miss Redfern's attorney notified.
He has been. Did you know the child that was killed?
Child. Tragic, tragic child. My God. Her grandfather get home?
No, he didn't.
When did this happen?
We found her about 10 minutes to seven. She hadn't been dead long.
I know.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
My secretary spoke to her.
Why don't you come back inside, Mr. Blitzen? No, not the Ellis apartment. We're not quite through there. Upstairs to Miss Redfern's.
In Red's apartment, Detective Ames took a statement from a pale, perspiring Rene Ortiz, who protested he knew nothing. He'd come home with a severe headache, he'd taken 3 aspirins, and he'd been awakened by the police at 7.
I believe you have a roommate, Mr. Ortiz, Mr. Leeds.
Bobby Leeds,
Where is Mr. Leeds now?
I am sorry. I cannot tell you. He is no longer living at my place. We had a little disagreement.
Where does he work?
No. Bobby does not work. He is a lily of the field. Occasionally, he acts. You might say he is a mimic, a female impressionist.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ortiz. You may go. Oh, and send up the boy, Phil Waters, will you?
Oui.
Incidentally, Mr. Blixen, you said a little girl called your office tonight. At what time was that?
About 6:30, I should guess. I had looked at my watch at 6:25, and my secretary said Heidi had called a little before that, and then she phoned back about 6:30.
And you spoke to the child at that time?
My secretary spoke to her.
Your secretary's name and address, Mr. Blixen?
Miss Mary McGrath, 400 and a half Willow Way, and that's in Glendale.
Would Miss McGrath be familiar with the little girl's voice?
Absolutely. They'd spoken to each other many times.
On the telephone,
On and off the telephone.
There's no way she could be fooled, not even by a professional mimic like a female impersonator?
Well, my secretary certainly didn't say anything. It was Heidi's voice as far as she was concerned. And that's all I can go on. May I ask one question?
Certainly.
Do you have the murder weapon?
Nope.
Then why have you arrested Miss Redfern?
Well, Miss Redfern stated she arrived home at approximately 6:45. She said she noticed the Ellis door open slightly, called to Heidi, got no answer, and walked in. Now, we came along a few minutes later, heard someone cry out. Miss Redfern was standing over the body with blood on her hands.
Shriver picked me up the next morning to go see Red where they were holding her at the Sybil Brand facility for women.
Oh, in my opinion, Ilse, it would have been better to concentrate on tying her to the Gladstone murder. Now they have to show a connection between Gladstone and Heidi, and I don't think they're going to be able to do that.
Is that your good news for the day?
Well, it's a try.
What are you dragging your heels about? Get her off the Gladstone murder. She bought a gun. Well, let them do a ballistics test on it.
Niels Frederick, I'm afraid there's a bit of a hitch there.
What do you mean?
You see, the other day when your boss Todd had Red fired, she went home, got in her newly repaired car, drove down to the pier, and took the boat trip to Catalina.
And threw the gun overboard.
Yes, that's right. It's at the bottom of the ocean. Nobody will ever find it.
When I saw Red come into the visiting room, she seemed to have grown smaller. Behind her, the police matron who brought her in stood and gazed like a cat at a remote distance. There was a glass wall between us, and Red's voice came to me through a phone.
Like my outfit?
How are they treating you? Do you need anything?
Could you send me the trades?
Oh, sure. They'll be lucky if Shriver doesn't sue for false arrest before it's over.
Don't tell me you two hamburgers still think I'm innocent.
As the day is long.
There's never a Kleenex around when you want one.
Red, have you heard from your father?
Yes, this morning. He thinks I did it. He advises I plead insanity and throw myself in the mercy of the court. Said to be sure to talk to the analyst who treated me after I killed my sister. But he's not coming to see me. How's Leonard Ellis?
Leonard, I don't know.
The police tell me he's been hospitalized. They found him in some bar. Told him about Heidi, and he began to get severe chest pains.
The poor guy. All right, I'll check into it. Red, did you notice anything out of the ordinary before you went into Ellis' apartment last night?
Just the door was open.
Was that usual?
Well, it was never open. They were all burglar freaks. They hear them every night. There are enough locks and chains and bolts to outfit a dungeon on every door.
Our time was up. The matron was approaching. I told Red I'd be back. She put her hand on the glass, palm flat, and I rested my palm on the other side against hers as though we were touching. I left the building. By the time I got back to the studio, I didn't think anything was worth too much. There was a strange secretary in my office. It took me a moment or two to remember that last night at the office, just before Jack and I had stepped out into the rain, Mary had told me she was flying out in the morning to Chicago to see her sick father. I smiled at the new secretary. She had the heat turned up and her coat over her shoulders, but none of it seemed to warm her in the least. I picked up all my messages from her desk, including one from Tibbetan Research. It read, The threatening letter, the words were cut out of Star Eyes Comics, April 15th, 1972 issue. Good man, Tippett. I spent the next 10 minutes on the phone. Good Samaritan Hospital to check on Leonard Ellis. Learned nothing, except that he was in intensive care. Hung up and got a call from Ames.
Nixon?
Yes.
I wanted to talk to your secretary, Mary McGrath, but I got somebody else. Thought I had the wrong office. Where is Miss McGrath?
In Chicago. Her father's sick, didn't I tell you?
No, you gave me her address in Glendale, but there's no one there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was pretty shook up last night. I've got the number right here. Just a minute. 427-3099. I don't remember the area code.
I'll get it. Thanks.
I spent the day at my desk going over all of the scripts that were ready to shoot. It was 5 o'clock when I got another call from Sergeant Ames.
We called the number you gave us in Chicago for your secretary, Miss McGrath. She wasn't there.
Well, her father's very ill. She might have been at the hospital.
Nope. Called a couple of her friends as well. No sign of her. So we went to the airline at L.A. here. She never got on the plane. Hey, Mr. Blixen?
I'm here. I'm trying to find an explanation. She was very close to her father. She told me he was dying.
Passed away at noon, Chicago time. Well, I'd better notify missing persons.
I hung up and sat thinking about Mary and the two deaths that had already occurred. Mary? How could she be involved? Was I losing my sanity? Was there a straight line through Dan Gladstone, Heidi, Mary? Where would it end? And with whom? Jack was parked in his usual place, waiting for me, reading the late edition of the Times and looking at the legs of starlets as they passed the checkout point at the gate.
Hi, Mr. Blixen. Hey, what do you hear from our girl?
I saw her this morning. She'll make it. Let the traffic clear a little bit, Jack. I just want to sit here for a minute.
You know, my wife, Dolores, she's got it all paid. She says they're railroading Miss Redfern, and she says the kid's grandfather did it.
What's she based that on?
Well, for one thing, the paper said there were 3 or 4 locks on the front door, and all of them were open. And Dolores figures the kid was waiting for whoever lived there to come in. The paper said she was on the couch, so she didn't open the door herself. The locks were off, and the guy came right in.
Unless he picked the locks first.
Why, you can't pick a lock without making some kind of noise.
Oh, but it was raining. That might have covered it.
Hey, what's the matter? Don't you want the old man to be guilty?
Something like that. Besides, he left the studio at the same time we did last night, 6:30 or thereabouts. He couldn't have gotten to the apartment, killed the girl, and split before Red arrived.
But when did she...
About 6:45.
Well, it'd be tight, but I think he could make it.
In 15 minutes?
I don't know. I have to run it myself.
Do it. Do it now. I want to go over there anyhow.
All right. You time it, but wait till I get out of the lot. Hey, I feel like Mario Andrade. Now, who's going to pay the fine if the cops stop me?
They'd better not stop you.
I hope you're right.
We crossed Santa Monica, turned right onto a congested alley, left a narrow street, and east again toward Vine. There were no automatic signals on Jack's route. At the boulevard stops, he paused and nosed at once into honking traffic. 12 minutes and 20 seconds later, we pulled to a stop in front of the fourplex.
Okay, how about that?
You're a professional driver, and you barely made it. Ellis was drunk. The streets were wet. No, I can't buy it. It's out of reason, all out of reason. Leonard Ellis was the only one in the whole house who couldn't have done it.
Except, of course, Miss Redfern, maybe?
Yeah, that's true. You better not wait, Jack. I want to pick up something from the garage, and no idea how long I'll be. I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, right.
This episode of Someone's Death continues, but our audition time's run out. This has been a special condensation of Zero Hour, not for broadcast. Remember, Monday, November 19th is a deadline for affiliate response. Stations are urged to contact station relations today. Zero Hour premieres December 17th at 7 p.m. We hope your station is with us. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.